Okay, we're dealing with the issue often referred to as Messianic Christology, what the Bible teaches about the coming of the Messiah, primarily focusing on first coming prophecies. And we're dealing with the topic in the three divisions of the Hebrew Bible, the Law, the Prophets, and the Writings. And yesterday we focused on the introductory material. We dealt with the Law. As far as the Prophets, we went through Isaiah, which has the most to say than any prophet concerning the Messiah's first coming as well as second coming. So now we turn to Jeremiah chapter 23. Okay, chapter 23, verse 5, "Behold, the days come, says Jehovah, that I raise up unto David a righteous branch. He shall reign as king and deal wisely and shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. His days Judah shall be saved, Israel shall dwell safely, and this is his name whereby he shall be called Jehovah, our righteousness." The prophecy itself is dealing with Messiah's rule over a saved Israel in the Messianic kingdom. That's a bit beyond our topic, but there's a couple of things relevant to the issue of the first coming and who the Messiah is. So in verse 5, for example, "A descendant of David sits upon the throne of David, ruling in righteousness and justice." And that would focus on his humanity and his Davidic descendancy. But in verse 6, he is given a name which is only applicable to God, and that is Yahweh, Jehovah, our righteousness, Adonai Tzedkenu. And again, the four-letter name of God is something that belongs to God alone, and no human being can have that name. So what this shows is that the rule, the future messianic ruler of the saved people of Israel in the kingdom is not just a man or just God, but is the God-man, the messianic God-man-king. That's the one key passage that would be relevant to the first coming within the book of Jeremiah. Let's move on now to the book of Micah. Let me summarize what this prophecy will teach us about the first coming. Basically, four things. Number one, the Messiah will be a descendant of David. Secondly, the Messiah is Jehovah himself. Thirdly, that would mean Messiah is the God-man. And fourthly, Messiah will be a king. Now we come to Micah chapter 5. Again, contextually, he's referring to the Messiah's role in the final battle, the War of Armageddon, also in the Messianic role concerning Israel's final regathering. When he talks about the origins of this individual, that again brings us to some points about the first coming. And he says in verse 2, "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, which are little to be among the thousands of Judah, yet out of he shall come one forth unto me, that is to be ruler of Israel, whose goings forth are from of old, from everlasting." Here again, notice that he brings out this individual that will be Israel's ultimate redeemer. has both a dual origin, both human and both divine. As to his human origin, he's going to be coming from Bethlehem, and not the Bethlehem of the Galilee, but the Bethlehem of Judah. That'll be his human origin. That's where he'll come out of. That's where he'll be born. But yet he has an origin that also precedes his birth in Bethlehem, who's gone forth as some old from everlasting, using the strongest Hebrew terms for the eternal aspects, in this case, eternity past. As to his human origin, then he will be coming into existence at a certain point of time. As divine origin, he is pre-existence, pre-exists his own birth. The two things we can learn from this is Messiah will be the God-man. Messiah will be the God-man. And secondly, He originates in the town of Bethlehem, in the Bethlehem of Judah. Let's go on to Zechariah chapter 9. As a side comment, if you look at chapter 2 of Zechariah, chapter 2 of Zechariah, some people see here a prophecy about Santa Claus, because in verse 6 he says, "Ho, ho, flee from the land of the north." That's not my interpretation, I'm just telling you what those other guys are saying. But Zechariah 9, as we mentioned yesterday, as we introduced the four categories of messianic prophecies, that one category is where the first and second coming are blended into one picture without conveying there's a gap of time between the first and second coming, a gap of time now 2,000 years long. And verses 9 and 10 give us that kind of pictorial, because verse 9 speaks about the first coming, and verse 10 speaks about the second coming, and there's no implication in this context. There's a long gap of time between the two comings. We know about the gap because of other prophecies. We just don't know it from this specific prophecy. So verse 9 begins to take call to rejoice. Now the background is that in verses 1 through 8, he's been giving a prophecy which ultimately was fulfilled by the conquest of Alexander the Great, when the land of Israel fell under Greek and Hellenistic authority. And that would not be a time of rejoicing, but now he calls for a time to rejoice in verse 9. "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion, shout, O daughter of Jerusalem," and the reason is, "Your king is coming to you." And the emphasis, this is your king. He'll be a Jewish king, not a Greek king. He's coming to you. He's not coming against the Jewish people, but on behalf of the Jewish people. And then in verse 9, you were given three descriptive terms about this person. Number one, he is just. He's characterized by the righteousness we just saw in Jeremiah 23, verses 5 and 6. Alexander died in a drunken stupor. Secondly, having salvation, while Alexander brought death everywhere he traveled. And thirdly, he is humble, lowly. Alexander came in the great pomp and power. And finally, in verse 9, you have the manner of his coming. He rides upon a donkey, even the colt, the foal of a donkey, a foal not yet broken in, whereas Alexander rode on a white steed. And so he makes a contrast between the Greek king, who will be Alexander the Great, in verses 1 through 8, and in a contrast to the future Jewish king, where his first coming came in a humble way. And the fulfillment of this came in Matthew 21, verses 1 through 11. Matthew 21, verses 1 through 11. And what became Palm Sunday, he rode into Jerusalem on a donkey, fulfilling that specific prophecy. Now, he did not at that time fulfill verse 10, that will await the second coming of the Messiah. Now, the issue that the rabbis raised with this passage, they agreed it was messianic, but had a hard time figuring it out because there are other prophecies such as Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6, other passages, and Daniel chapter 7, they come riding in the clouds of heaven. Is he coming in the clouds, or is he coming riding on a donkey? The rabbis came up with two different answers. One answer says there'll be one way or the other. If at the time of the Messiah's coming, Israel is living in wickedness, he'll come riding upon a donkey. If at the time of Messiah's coming, Israel happens to be living in righteousness, they'll come riding upon a cloud. So one way or the other. Most rabbis were not comfortable making a choice between one way or the other, since both were inspired scripture. And so the majority came up with a view that there'll be two different messiahs. The first messiah they labeled to be the Messiah, son of Joseph. And he's the one that's going to come to fulfill the the suffering and dying Messiah, such as Isaiah 53, as we saw yesterday. And so the first Messiah, son of Joseph, will fulfill those prophecies. He will then be killed in the Gog and Magog war. After he dies in the Gog and Magog war, there will come the second Messiah, the son of David, who will be the conquering Messiah. He will win the Gog and Magog war, raise the first Messiah back to life, and bring in the Messianic kingdom. The majority view in the early centuries was that there would be two different Messiahs, each coming one time. But the biblical answer is simply only one Messiah coming two different times. First, to fulfill the humbling and suffering passages and dying prophecies, but then coming again for the purpose of fulfilling the conquering and conquest prophecies. Let's go to a really key prophecy within this book, and that is chapter 11. I mentioned yesterday the prophet who had the most to say about the Messiah, both his first and second coming, happens to be Isaiah. But the second prophet who had a lot to say about these elements, both first and second coming, happened to be Zechariah the prophet. And with the grand prophecies that we find within the book is going to be found here in chapter 11, verses 1 through 17, especially verses 4 through 14. He begins with describing a massive devastation of the land in verses 1, 2, and 3. Given geography, the devastation shows it will come from north to south. It will cover the whole land. It's the kind of devastation that was fulfilled as a result of the two Jewish revolts against Rome. And the first devastation came in the year AD 66 through AD 70. The second devastation came in the years 132 through 135 AD. And I would describe the coming massive devastation of the land, which will be fulfilled by the Roman Empire. He then gives us two reasons why the devastation is coming. The first reason, which is the reason we'll be focusing on, is chapter 11, verses 4 through 14, for rejecting the true shepherd. The result of rejecting the true shepherd will result in the first devastation of AD 70. And in verses 15 through 17, the second reason is for accepting the false shepherd, and accepting the false shepherd results in the second devastation of 135 AD. Let's focus on the first reason. We'll simply summarize the second reason later. But in verses 4, 5, and 6, Zechariah is asked to fulfill a prophetic role. And often God asks the prophets to play character roles as a character lesson for the people of Israel. Isaiah played the role, Jeremiah played the role, more frequently Ezekiel played that role. To play a messianic role, a role the Messiah himself will fulfill. And Zechariah is asked to play the role of the Good Shepherd. So in verse 4, he's told to feed the flock of slaughter. Thus says Jehovah my God, Zechariah's God, feed the flock of slaughter. The flock of slaughter is Israel, destined for the devastation of verses 1, 2, and 3. It's a flock that is already destined for the slaughter, and yet that's the flock that the good shepherd, Zechariah, plays, is to feed. And in verses 5 and 6, he describes the condition of the flock. And two things about the condition. First of all, in verse 5, it's a flock that's been abandoned by man. Their possessors slay them and do not hold themselves guilty. In the context of fulfillment, the possessors were the Romans, who periodically just sent the soldiers against the Jews for any excuse and killing many. Men, women, and children without holding themselves responsible or guilty. But furthermore, their own shepherds, these are the Jewish leaders, their own shepherds pity them not. They that say, blessed be Jehovah, for I am rich, And so they sell the poor people to become rich. This was more true of the Sadducees than the Pharisees. And so their own shepherds pitied them not. That was true of both Pharisees and Sadducees in the first century. It's a flock already abandoned by man. But secondly, verse 6, it's a flock already abandoned by God. And now God says, "For I will no more pity the inhabitants of the land." Instead, he says, "Lo, I will deliver the men, everyone, into the hand of his neighbor, in the hand of his king." First of all, in the hand of his neighbor. When the Romans began the siege of Jerusalem in the year 68 AD, the second siege, Jerusalem was defended by three different Jewish generals that had their own military force. And often they began fighting each other, killing each other's soldiers, destroying each other's foodstuff, that ultimately led to a severe famine in the city, which would not have happened if they had maintained the food supply. And that weakened the Jewish defenses, allowing the Romans to begin making their various ramparts to break through the wall. It says, "Into the hands of his king I will deliver them." They had no Jewish king, but they had a Roman king. And the Sadducean element in the crowd, in the trial of Jesus, cried out. This is in the Gospel of John, John chapter 19, verse 15, John 19, 15. "We have no king but Caesar. We have no king but Caesar." Now, the Pharisees would never say this, but the Sadducees would. And so since they rejected the Messiah as the king, and they will claim Caesar as the king, into Caesar's hand will they be delivered. So two elements here that will bring about the coming devastation. First of all, Jewish fighting among themselves. Secondly, owning Caesar as their king. And the verse ends, "Out of their hand I will not deliver them." And by the time the first Jewish revolt had actually ended, according to Josephus, about 1,100,000 Jews were killed. 1,100,000 Jews were killed. That's at least 25% of the population of that day. And furthermore, 97,000 Jews were taken to slavery to work in various Roman projects in the empire. So Zechariah is now told, play a messianic role, the role of the Good Shepherd. Feed a flock already destined to be slaughtered. They have no pity from their owners. They have no pity by their own leaders. They're abandoned by man, already abandoned by God. So in verses 7 through 11, we have the carrying out of the commission. And so verse 7, we read about the feeding of the flock of slaughter. So I fed the flock of slaughter. He began feeding the people as a whole, the flock as a whole, all Israel. But then notice, verily, the poor of the flock. And while the offer was made of his messiahship to the whole nation of Israel, it was only a remnant that would accept him, and these were the poor of the flock. You see this in Matthew chapter 9, verses 35 and 36. Matthew 9, verses 35 and 36. And so in the outline of the Gospels, he became as the Messiah, offering himself as the Messiah, offering to Israel the kingdom, the nation as a whole. But the rejection came in Matthew chapters 12 and 13. At that point, he focuses more on the Jews who believe, the believing remnant of that day. The verse goes on to say, "I took unto me two staves," or staffs. "One I call beauty," a Hebrew word that means graciousness, and this first staff was for the purpose of protecting the flock, using it to beat off any wild animals such as lions and bears that want to eat of the flock. And the other staff he called bands, meaning binding, and the purpose of the second staff was to keep the flock together, to keep the flock unified. And verse 7 says, "I fed the flock." The flock was fed and his commission was fulfilled. In verse 8, he points out he received opposition from other members of the nation. So he says, "I cut off three shepherds in 1 month." In the context of fulfillment, these would be three categories of leaders: the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the scribes. And he points out there was mutual antagonism. "My soul was weary of them, the soul also loved me." And we see this antagonism through all four Gospels, but particularly in Matthew's Gospel. In verse 9 came a point of a cessation of the feeding. Then said I will not feed you. At some point comes a rupture between the good shepherd and the flock as a whole, the people as a whole. And so he terminates the feeding of the flock in order to leave them to the natural course of events. That which dies, let it die. That which is to be cut off, let it be cut off. Let it be left, eat everyone the flesh of another. And in keeping with the cessation, he breaks one of the staffs. In verse 10, he breaks the staff beauty. I took my staff beauty and cut asunder. At this point, grace and protection are removed. That I might break my covenant which I had made with all the peoples. And now a covenantal understanding with the Gentiles was broken, yet that now the Gentiles would be allowed to hurt Israel. Now you see this in the fulfillment stage in Luke chapter 19, verses 41 through 44. Luke 19, 41 through 44, where at the end of that ride upon the donkey that Zechariah prophesied in chapter 9, at the end of that very ride, while people are proclaiming his messiahship, but a bit too late since they already rejected him, he pronounces a coming destruction upon the city and the nation, and the temple be torn down till there is not one stone on top of another. Later on in the Upper Room Discourse in Luke chapter 21, verse 24, Luke 21, verse 24, he goes on to prophesy the Jews who survive will be forced to go into exile until the fullness of the Gentiles, until the times of the Gentiles is fulfilled. And the times of the Gentiles will be fulfilled. And that's going to happen only with the second coming. Now, the timing of this cessation, this break, is recorded in Matthew chapter 12, verses 22 to 45. Matthew chapter 12, verses 22 to 45 is in that passage, the leadership of Israel, led by the Pharisees, decreed he was not the Messiah and made that statement public. And furthermore, they explained his ability is a way to perform these unique miracles that were never done before. They explained that away by merely saying he himself is possessed by the prince of demons, Beelzebub. He himself is demonized by the prince of demons. And that's when the ministry of Jesus changes radically in 4 years. I've spoken on this in previous conferences. But just to summarize, at that point, he no longer provides signs for the nation. Now the signs are going to be strictly the training of the apostles for their future work because of that rejection, the work they'll be conducting in the book of Acts. As for his miracles, until Matthew 12, he performed miracles for the benefit of the masses, and he did not require them to have faith first. After that, he performs miracles only by responding to needs of individuals. And now he tells them that they will, that the individuals, and only they will receive the benefits of his ministry. But they must have faith first to receive the miracle. Also along the miracles, until Matthew 12, when he healed someone, he would tell that person, go and proclaim what God has done for you. After Matthew 12, every time he heals someone, he tells them, don't tell anyone what God has done for you. He initiates a policy of silence, and those who benefit from his messianic power are prohibited to tell anyone about it. The third change concerns the message that he and the apostles would be proclaiming. And until Matthew 12, they went all over Israel, city to city, synagogue to synagogue, proclaiming Jesus to be the Messiah. After Matthew 12, he will even prohibit his own apostles to tell anyone who he is. So in Matthew chapter 16, when Peter makes his famous confession and says, you are the Messiah, the Son of the God, living one, Messiah says to Peter, don't tell anyone who I am. And they too must follow the new policy of silence until that will be rescinded in Matthew 28 with the Great Commission. And the fourth change is his method of teaching. Until Matthew 12, when he taught the people publicly, he did so in a way they could and did understand. As in Matthew 5-7, the Sermon on the Mount. And Matthew points out that when he was finished with that sermon, the people understood exactly what he was saying and claiming. And furthermore, they could see where he differed with the scribes and Pharisees. But after Matthew 12 and Matthew chapter 13, that changes as well. From then on, when he teaches publicly, it's only parabolically. So they will not and cannot understand. So what Zechariah here prophesies, there's going to be a change. Relationship between the good shepherd and the people as a whole did take place in the context of Matthew chapters 12 and 13. And verse 11 describes the effect and the poor of the flock. It was broken in that day. And the poor of the flock that gave heed unto me knew it was the word of Jehovah. So the remnant, those who did believe on him, understood what he was saying. And just gave them a warning in Luke chapter 21, verse 20 and 21. Luke 21, verse 20 and 21. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that desolation is at hand. If you're in the city, get out. If you're out of the city, don't go in. And the Jewish believers were prohibited from defending the city in the first Jewish revolt against Rome. Now, the revolt broke out in the year AD 66. Initially, the then Roman governor, Sestus Gallus, assumed this was merely a local revolt, and he brought legions out of Caesarea and brought them up to besiege Jerusalem. And the Messianic community took that to be the sign Jesus gave them. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, know that desolation is at hand. They knew they had to abandon the city, but with the Romans surrounding it, they weren't able to do so. But then Gallus realized that this was not a local revolt, it was a grassroots revolt throughout the country, and in fact, Jewish forces were cutting his supply lines. He was forced to go back to Caesarea. So temporarily, from 66 to 68, there was no besieging of the city. At that point, the Messianic community of Jerusalem, numbering at least 20,000 strong, they left the city. They were joined by Messianic Jews from Judea, from the Galilee, and from the Golan. And they went to a city called Pella, P-E-L-L-A, P-E-L-L-A, on the east side of the Jordan, not that far, not that many miles south of the Sea of Galilee, but outside the war zone, one of the 10 cities of the Decapolis, and they waited the war out in that city. As a result, the Messianic community saved the massive slaughter described in verses 1, 2, and 3. And so indeed in verse 11, the poor of the flock understood what he was saying. Now verses 12 through 14, we have the price of the good shepherd. And in verse 12, we see the attitude of the Jewish leaders to the work of Zechariah. And Zechariah is now told to go to Jewish leaders and tell them, we did not agree to any kind of payment or salary up front in advance. So simply pay me what you think my work is worth to you. If it's worth something to you, pay me accordingly. But if it's worth nothing to you, it'll be fine to pay me nothing. It would have been less insulting to pay him nothing. But what they do is they pay him 30 pieces of silver, which at that point of time became a symbolic price of contempt. It goes back to the Mosaic law in the book of Exodus chapter 21 and verse 32. Exodus 21 verse 32. Where if you own an ox and your ox go to death your neighbor's slave, you're obligated to pay your neighbor the price of 30 pieces of silver. That was the valued price of a death slave. And as Jewish history continued, that became a symbolic price of contempt. The one way to show contempt for someone is to pay him 30 pieces of silver. And the message would be, how much are you worth? You're worth the price of a dead slave. Now, when the chief priests were negotiating with Judas, They didn't settle for 21 or 29 or 31 pieces of silver. They settled for 30, showing their contempt for the one who claimed to be the Messiah himself. But something else we should not miss, because the ones who were negotiating with Judas were the chief priests. And the funds for the chief priests came from the temple treasury. One of the purposes of the temple treasury is for the purpose of purchasing sacrifices. Now, that was not their intent that day, but what they did that day, they purchased the sacrifice, the final sacrifice for sin. And the fulfillment is recorded in Matthew chapter 26, verses 14 through 16. Matthew 26, 14 through 16. Having received the 30 pieces of silver, Zechariah now gets a second commission in verse 13. And Jehovah said unto me, cast into the potter. He's told to take the 30 pieces and throw it into the potter's area within the temple compound. And then notice what else God says. This was the goodly prize I was prized of by them. The goodly prize I was prized of by them, God himself. And it's a sign of contempt. It's a tone of sarcasm, the splendid value they gave you. And what he prophesies is that someday God himself will be sold out for the price of a dead slave. And as the Messianic God-man, when they paid Judas the 30 pieces of silver, they did sell out the Messianic God-man for the price of a dead slave. In the second part of verse 13, we see the carrying out of the second commission. I take the 30 pieces of silver, I'll cast them into the potter in the house of Jehovah. And this is exactly what Judas would do in Matthew 27, verses 3 through 10. Matthew 27, verses 3 through 10. And then came the breaking of bands, the second staff in verse 14. Now cut mine other staff, even bands. Why? To break up the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. And not unity of the Jewish forces is destroyed. The factions form. Civil strife causes Jerusalem to fall to Rome, resulting in Jewish dispersion, which he will shortly predict in chapter 13, verses 7 through 9. To summarize this section, before the massive destruction of verses 1, 2, and 3, Messiah will arrive. Again, showing has to come sometime before AD 70. Secondly, the remnant of Israel, there'll be a remnant of Jews that will follow him. But thirdly, others will value him to be equal to that of a dead slave. And selling him out for the price of 30 pieces of silver. So fourthly, the consequences, people are given over to Gentiles and scattered or dispersed. And the fulfillment of the Messiah portrayed as the Good Shepherd, you'll find in John chapter 10, verses 11 through 18. John chapter 10, 11 through 18. So the first reason for the devastation of verses 1 and 2 is verses 4 through 14, rejecting the true shepherd. There's a second reason in verses 15 through 17, that's for accepting a foolish shepherd, a false Messiah. Now, some people interpret verse 15 through 17 to refer to the future Antichrist, but I think it has a more nearer fulfillment. Now, in Jewish history, the first one to ever claim to be the Messiah happened to be Yeshua, Jesus of Nazareth, the first one to make the claim to be the Messiah. A century later becomes a long history of many false messiahs. The first of one is a man named Simon Bar Kosiba. Simon Bar B-R Kosiba, K-O-S-I-B-A, K-O-S-I-B-A. And he's the one that led the second Jewish revolt against Rome beginning the year 132 AD. And for the first half of that revolt, from 132 to 133, he had victory against one Roman garrison after another, one Roman legion after another. And at that point, the Messianic Jews also participated in that revolt, because the prohibition didn't apply to the second Jewish revolt as it did in the first one. Because of his many victories, the key rabbi of that period, Rabbi Akiba, A-K-I-B-A, led the Sanhedrin to proclaim Simon Bar Kokhba to be the Messiah of Israel. And he renamed Bar Kokhba to be Bar Kokhba. And Kokhba is the Aramaic term for star. Simon, son of the star, because he connected this Simon Bar Kokhba with the prophecy we looked at yesterday in the book of Numbers, a star will arise out of Jacob, in Numbers chapter 24, verse 14, verse 17, Numbers 24, verse 17. So now the revolt was under the Messianic banner, and the Messiah was Simon Bar Kokhba, and the Messianic Jews could not participate under that Messianic banner, so they withdrew from the revolt, creating a final division between the Messianic Jewish community and the larger Jewish community. But as a result of claiming to be the Messiah under Rabbi Akiba, at that point he began losing one battle after another. He finally was forced to leave Jerusalem to go to nearby town where he would make his last defense. And in the final onslaught, he was killed in battle. And that will lead to a second devastation of the land, of verses 1, 2, and 3 that happened in 135 A.D., as a result, Jewish population began to decrease and decrease in the land. As a result of the acceptance of the first false Messiah, Simon Bar Kokhba. Let's turn now to Zechariah chapter 12. Look at verse 10, Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10. And thou poured out upon the house of David, and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the spirit of grace and supplication. They shall look unto me whom they have pierced. They shall mourn for him as one mourns for only some, shall be in bitterness for him as one is in bitterness for his firstborn. In context, he's dealing with Armageddon, and this was national salvation within Armageddon. So verses 1 through 9, all the armies of all the nations come against the Jewish people. But at that point in chapter 12, verse 10, through chapter 13, at the end of chapter 13, Israel comes to national salvation. In chapter 14, that brings in the second coming and kingdom. Now, what's relevant here for the first coming is the phrase, they shall look unto me whom they have pierced, meaning he was previously pierced by them, and now they will look unto him. So as far as the piercing facet that occurred at the first coming, them looking unto the one who previously pierced will be in preparation for the second coming. As what's relevant to us is the piercing of the Messiah. So we can derive 2 points from this passage. Number one, Messiah's first coming will be rejected. Messiah's first coming will be rejected. And secondly, he's killed by piercing, which is the mode of crucifixion. And then Zechariah gives us one more prophecy in chapter 13, verse 7. Chapter 13, verse 7. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, against the man that is my fellow, says Jehovah of hosts. Smite the shepherd, the sheep shall be scattered. Now turn my hand upon the little ones. What we have in verse 7 is a summary of what he prophesied back in chapter 11. Again, chapter 13, verse 7 summarizes what he said in all of chapter 11. So he says, smite the shepherd, the sheep shall be scattered. This focuses not so much on the manner of his death, but rather a symbol of a violent death. But notice, against my shepherd, God's shepherd. Now, how can one to be God's own shepherd implies some kind of equality? Then he says, against the man that is my fellow, says Jehovah. The Hebrew word for fellow means equal. Against the man, humanity, that is my fellow, my equal, Jehovah says. So again, you have a God-man concept. Against the man focuses on his humanity. And then my equal focuses on his deity. And result of rejecting that shepherd and causing the violent death, the sheep shall be scattered. And there was the initial scattering in AD 70 and the final forced dispersion in 135 AD. He then moves on to the future time when we'll see a national salvation of Israel. And in verse 89, he points out that in the coming tribulation, two-thirds will die, but the whole third that remain will come to saving faith. At the end of verse 9, that in turn will trigger the second coming and kingdom in chapter 14. But the key points to notice here is the Messiah will be the God-man. Secondly, the Messiah dies a violent death. And thirdly, it results in the massive dispersion of the flock. The last prophecy within the prophets is going to be in Malachi chapter 3. Malachi 3, verse 1. Behold, I send my messenger. He shall prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, and the messenger of the covenant whom you desire, behold, he is come, says Jehovah of hosts. He predicts the coming of two individuals. A messenger, they'll prepare the way, and then the second person will be Messiah himself. Now, chapter 2 ended with the phrase, where is the God of justice? Where's the God of justice? And that's answered in chapter 3, verse 1. Behold, I send my messenger, and this messenger will be ultimately fulfilled by John the Baptist. And the purpose, he shall prepare the way before me. He'll be Messiah's forerunner, have a people ready to accept him as the Messiah once John identifies to the people exactly who the Messiah is. And following the forerunner, suddenly the Messiah comes to his temple. One of his first actions was to come to the temple compound after the baptism of John and overthrow the money changer's table and force out the sellers of the sacrifices. This would be the God of justice. And so what you have here is a prophecy of the forerunner, which was fulfilled by John the Baptist, whereas the Isaiah chapter 40 prophecy was merely an application to John the Baptist. This is more specifically speaking of the Lord John the Baptist in the future. And so the one key point this makes, the first coming will be preceded by a forerunner. The first coming will be preceded by a forerunner.